This morning, I have with me Naomi Pilula, a woman of resilience, a woman of love, a woman who has gone viral with her spread of self-love for herself and teaching and telling us all how to self-love and be yourself. Her story over the last few months is phenomenal, so incredible, and really proud to have her in the studio with us. And I really look forward to spending the next 45 to an hour with her. Morning, Naomi. How are you?
Good morning. I'm good, thanks. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. So you're sitting here, having come to Nkwazi. I am so honored because this is your first Zambian unofficial interview, conversation after your interview with People magazine.
Yes.
We are honored as Nkwazi. Really, really awesome. Welcome.
Thank you.
You've come to us after having finished your exams yesterday. Mm-hmm. Feeling relaxed, I hope. Exhausted. But with us still.
Yes.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Naomi, we're just going to have a conversation. Nothing deep. And I know we haven't met before. Mm-hmm. I'm so glad to meet you. I've read a lot about you. So we're going to go through that and kind of like pick a few things that people haven't learned about you or things that people don't know.
Sure.
So I'm going to make this very traditional in terms of the angle we're going to take. So okay. I just need to ask you about your early years.
Okay.
Who is Naomi and where did you come from?
Righty then. Naomi was born in 1987 in Kalulushi, Zambia.
Right.
So small town on the Copper Belt.
Yeah.
Born to Ernest Impala and Nalio Kapulia. Uh-huh. Suilanji Pirula. So last born of seven kids.
Yeah.
Grew up, spent my whole life in the Copper Belt. I literally went from the Copper Belt and flew to Australia. I didn't even do the whole Osaka route.
Proper Coppola. And what did your parents do there?
My dad was in the mines.
Yeah.
By the time my mom was born, by the time I was born,
yeah,
my mom had seven kids. So she just said, I'm done. I'm staying home. So my whole life, my mom was home.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, so pretty much Copper Belt means mining.
And then you're saying seven children and you're the last.
Yes.
So what does the other six before this look like?
We are scattered in terms of professions and personalities. Everything from university lecturer to mining engineer to geophysicist, auditor, accountant, hotel sector as well. So
were your parents the traditional educationists who like took education really seriously, it sounds like?
It does, because like they were born in the 1940s, so before independence.
Yeah.
So they were very big on, now we've got an opportunity to get educated, so please do get educated.
Yeah.
My dad was very, very serious when it came to school. I remember once going for a parent-teachers conference, and for one of my courses, I came out first. But because it was English, but because it was in the 70s, my dad was like, but what can she do to do better? And the teacher was like, but she was the highest. And he was like, so if she fails and she's still the highest, is it still good?
As in, what can she do with it? Do you think that was the thinking? What can she do with it?
No, he was more along the lines of your grades matter. It doesn't matter what position you are. It's how much grades. So at least I didn't get any pressure to be number one. Because he didn't care about that.
Yeah.
He just cared about the marks you have.
Okay.
Because when going to uni, that's what matters.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, that would make sense back in those days.
Yeah.
Yeah, that would make sense. And so, but in the household, being the youngest, what did that feel like, look like?
Coming from older parents,
yeah,
like by the time I was born, they were in their 40s. So growing up, they were more like, they won't die.
Yes.
that kind of thing. I feel like my parents were kind of been there, done that by the time me and my siblings came along. There's a large gap between the top four, what I call the top four, and the bottom three. There's a six-year gap.
There's always a gap.
So the top four kind of grew up together and us, the bottom three, because the bottom three, we have 3 years between us.
Yeah.
So we grew up kind of together. So... I was the last born to my parents. To my siblings, like any typical African home, I was the tumatuma person.
Yes.
I was the one who was sent for everything. I was the one who was, if you want something, go and ask dad. He doesn't say no to you.
Yes.
So I think that balance kind of helped me not become the spoiled brat, because I spent a lot of time with my siblings. So they kind of kept me grounded.
And then the older four, do you, even up till now, do you regard them as almost like your parents, or like respect them in that?
Yes and no. There's a 15-year gap between myself and the firstborn. Uh-huh. So by the time I was 2 years old, she had already gone off for uni. So I actually, growing up, did not spend physical time with the first and the second born, because they had gone to uni and they had gone abroad. Mm. So I didn't spend a lot of time. Third and fourth born, yes. We spent a lot of time together. But I think because my parents always treated us as kind of equal, they didn't kind of put this whole scenario in our heads that, oh, they're older, so obey them. So, yes, there's African culture where, yes, I do respect them because they are older. But before, my mom and dad were all the same.
Oh.
Yeah.
And how did, amongst you, so obviously I feel like your parents had a good handle on the family. How did Christianity, I presume it was Christianity, play a role in the home?
I think, I can't remember when I got saved. I can't pinpoint the age, the time, because we always said the sinner's prayer, according to my mom. But one thing I do know is having a relationship with God from a very young age.
Mm.
My mom was the one who basically took the whole teaching your children about the Bible, about the Word of God, about having a relationship with God. She was the forerunner with all those things. And so growing up, it looked like every night you would gather in one of our rooms and do your prayers and read the Bible. She was very big on memorizing scripture. To this day, I'm so grateful because that scripture is in
too.
My head.
Because you do too.
Yes.
Yeah.
I'm so grateful for that. She was very, very big on having a personal relationship with God.
Mm.
From as far back, she would always be like, me, I'm going to heaven. I don't know about you, but I know I'm going to heaven. Yeah. So you have to have your own relationship.
Yeah.
So because of that, from a very young age, and I think she was big on that because her father was a reverend. But she talks about the fact that it was only when she became an adult that she understood the concept of salvation and being able to have a personal relationship with God. So she grew up with that gap of understanding about God and faith. And so she made it a point that when we were growing up, she taught us from a young age that it's not about your parents, it's not about my faith, it's about you having your own personal faith. So yeah, it was some mornings she would look at you and she'd be like, you haven't prayed, go back. Yeah, so yeah, and yeah.
Are you all still with strong faith?
Yes. Yes. I would say all of us have got our own personal faith journeys. We still have very personal grounding in our own faith.
So, and it must be one thing that brings you all together still.
Yes. I mean, character-wise.
Despite where you are.
Yes. Yeah. Despite where we are, we're very different characters as well.
Yeah.
So sometimes we gel, sometimes we don't. But I think universally speaking, we all have our own faith and we all love and care for each other in that manner. Yeah.
So I've heard about your mom. I know your dad played a very key role in your life. So I want to know about him and your relationship.
Okay. I am dad's little girl. I am the last born. I think last borns tend to be that, especially if they're female. I think the thing with me and my dad is, between my parents, my dad is more of the person who likes kids, shockingly enough, having seven of them, you would think my mom would mellow down. But so because of that, Saturdays looked like going to the farm with dad.
Mm.
or going to the cricket club or the golf. So because of that, yes, I know how to play cricket.
Golf,
yes. We grew up, my mom bought us golf clubs as well, kids' golf clubs. So we would all play golf. Thank God we have a yard that was big enough that we would actually create holes and play golf in our backyard.
That's awesome.
So dad was always the person who you respected at home. In the early days, he was the person who's like, during the holidays, if dad is coming home, you know, dad's coming home, we haven't bathed yet. Everyone scrambles to go and bath and everything like that. But as we grew older, it became more of a relationship where you go to him for advice. You actually actively seek out conversations with him around what's going on, around career, around different decisions that you need to make. My dad is a very big stickler for, he'll respect you. He will respect you.
He'll hear you out.
He will, what he wants to know is what led you to making that decision. And so we would always say when it comes to dad, he'll always ask the four W's at an age, the what, why, where, when, and how. And so he would, even when you're asking for something, just know that he's going to ask you, why are you doing it? When is it going to happen? Does it? And then at the end of everything, you'd be like, but do you really have to do it? And so we grew into people who naturally, before I make a decision, there's so many things I have to factor in. Simply because if you're even going to convince dad about the decision, you'd have already done your background work to be able to answer all his questions. Mm. And so, yeah, I think it was more as children, we were spending a lot of time with him as he was doing the things that he does at the farm, like a cricket club, at the golf club. And I remember even if he was meeting up with friends, we would be the only ones that he would bring. So his friends would come on their own, but he would be the one who would bring his kids along. Yeah. So he would be with them at a corner. We would be playing around by ourselves. But we always knew Saturday was definitely spending it with dad.
And today?
Today, I'm the only one in Lusaka. Everyone else is on the Copper Belt. Yeah. I try and make sure I do spend time, like my annual leaves, I do make sure I spend about 2 weeks at home. Just to spend time with my parents. I have to put a reminder on my phone to call them weekly to just make sure that happens.
Are they still in Kalalushi or in another part of the Copper Belt?
At both. So Kalalushi, Kitwe.
And a reminder on the phone, that's like kind of says a lot about our careers and the way the world is, right?
It does. And I know people may think that that's a little bit like, but why do you need a reminder? But it's simply because if it's going to happen, and I value it to happen, I'll put a reminder on my phone.
Yeah, make it happen.
Make it happen, yeah.
Yeah, because our lives are so busy, to be really honest. And you sometimes forget the really obvious things.
Yes, and you take it for granted. I think spending a lot of time abroad, it came into a rhythm of no news is good news. Because you only end up calling when there's something up, when you need help and things like that. So to get out of that rut of saying, every time I call them, they're like, what's going on? What's happening? It had to be a regular conversation so that they know that, okay, she does this regularly. Mm-hmm. So it's not necessarily that when she calls me that is.
No, and actually it's true. I think, you know, when people did go to university or school abroad, you would be frightened when you got that call.
Yeah.
Because cell phones weren't there, obviously, but you'd have a bit of your heart would jump. Tell me about why you decided to, I want to talk about your education, because mm-hmm. I know this is Australia, and I love hearing about Australia because I've never been, and it's just, no, it sounds so delicious. What led you to make the decision to, I guess, study law then? Mm-hmm. Maybe not, and go to Australia. And I want to hear about what that experience was like. So maybe why you decided to study law, because mm-hmm. I've seen that the choices amongst all seven of you are so wide.
Yes.
Why law and why you?
Okay, so my family would tell me they've always known I'd be a lawyer. Very argumentative. But I didn't. We have this thing when you finish high school where you have a talk. We call it the talk amongst us kids. And with dad about what you want to study. So like I said, he's highly respectful. Mm. He respects your decisions.
So you graduated from where?
Here? From Impelembe Secondary School. Yes. So again, mining kid.
Yes, yes, yes.
So
yes,
went
yes.
to Trust School, Kalushi Trust School.
Right.
Impelembe, finished there.
We can see the discipline.
Yes. And then, so after high school, it was the case of what do you want to study? So you have the conversation with that. All of us have had it. And at the point of time where you have it, you would have, he starts off with asking you, what do you imagine yourself doing every day? In terms of work, what do you see yourself doing? And then he'll work himself backwards to say that, okay, in order for you to be doing this, what do you have to study? So for me, that looked like sitting in a corner office of a skyscraper building in high heels, doing contracts and mergers and acquisitions and dealing with high level negotiations. That's what I was thinking in my head, like, this is what I want to do. And these are the days before suits, so I can't even blame that.
But high heels were for sure.
But there. High heels were definitely there. I blame my mother for that. She had a whole collection. But yeah, so working myself, having that conversation with him, he was like, okay, that sounds like law, but it also sounds like some kind of business is attached to that. So he also asked me to talk to a few other people, including my older sister, because she went into accounting. And so he's like, you may want to talk to her just to find out if this is what you want to do, and then come back to me. So I did. And I think it's because I started out knowing that, well, thinking that I would end up in the States for uni. Mm-hmm. So I was researching on what that looks like.
Hence the skyscraper.
Yes. Yes, the skyscraper.
Researching what that looks like. Yeah.
And then it did look like law, but in the US, law is a postgraduate degree. Mm-hmm. And so I needed to figure out what to do as undergrad. So I was talking to my sister about what that looks like. She's done accounting. So at first I thought that was what it was. She's like, no, what you're telling me is not what it is. You may look more into economics because you're looking at factors and fundamentals of how things work. So that may be more the key than accounting. So I was like, okay, that sounds interesting. I was looking at different unis because my dad is very big on, you know, just because you've studied abroad doesn't mean it's a good uni. So he was big on what is the ranking of the university. So he preferred you going to the UNSA of other countries. So even in terms of the unis I could apply to, it was like, okay. He was more along the lines of the top 50 in the world. So he had to narrow it down.
No pressure?
None whatsoever. One thing you have to know about my parents is that what they believe that we can do as kids, to this day, I still get shocked. So because of that, I even wrote SATs before that. And then I'd also written the Cambridge GCE on top of my ECZ, simply because it's...
Just to open up the...
It's easier to get accepted in international universities if you've got those qualifications. But he was also of the view that I'm Zambian, and so I should have a Zambian grade 12 certificate. So
But you didn't feel it.
I think at that point, we're used to it.
Yes.
Our Zambian curriculum is actually very good. So in terms of what I needed to, there were some things I needed to add on top in terms of extra lessons. Impelembe was also a center for writing the Cambridge GCE. Mm. So it was just, at the same time we're writing our grade 12, we're also writing Cambridge. And there were quite a number of students in my intake who was also doing that for the same reason. And so we were like, you would be, for example, writing chemistry for Cambridge in the morning and math for ECZ in the afternoon. Then in January, I think around then, I also wrote the SATs. Choosing the uni and then trying to apply to it, got in, got accepted. And then it was me and my brother. So he's a year older than me, but I was put in the same grade as him. My mom was really big on, you have to be together. And so I was a year younger than my classmates because of that. And so we were both going to go to uni at the same time.
Okay.
So both of us at uni in America would have been very expensive. So my dad sat us down and said, I can't afford to take both of you there. So you may want to start looking elsewhere and what it looks like. So Australia became the next best thing.
And Australia then was also, even now, was big.
Yes, it was big. And even when it comes to unis, again, you could find unis in the top 50. So it became the next best thing. University fees are not as expensive as the States. And then in Australia, law is undergrad. So all of a sudden, I was like, oh, okay, so I can just start off doing law. Also, I was big on the fact that if I'm going to be out of the country, so that meant that I didn't want to go to Western Australia, Perth, where there is a whole Zambian community.
Right.
I wanted to really escape. And so I chose the opposite coast, the East Coast, with Queensland. The Sunshine Coast. So I was...
But together with your brother, right?
We're together with my brother.
Right.
Yes. So, we went to the same uni. It was undergrad, but what the beauty about the University of Queensland and a number of other Australian universities is that they've got a conjoint program, meaning that you can study two degrees at the same time. It's a longer program, so instead of law taking 4 years, the conjoint program takes 5.5 years. But you finish with 2 degrees.
Awesome.
So it was because I was already in the mindset that I will have 2 degrees at the end of the day, and now you're giving me the option of just having them at once, then might as well do that.
Did your brother do the same?
He started off the same, but then he said, you know what? Nah, fam. I'm just going to do my mining engineering and we're good to go. It's funny because now he's looking at the MBA and I keep on telling him, I'm like, you could have done it and
at the time. Right.
Yeah. But yeah, so started off with economics and law, like I had mentioned.
Yes.
Quickly found out economics was not my cup of tea. So I changed to a Bachelor of Commerce, majoring in accounting. I came home for one holiday and I helped my dad with the books and I realized, you know what? I can't do this. Not as a job.
And so it took the law route.
I took, so under commerce, I changed from accounting to finance.
Tell me, being out in Queensland, you said you didn't want to go to Perth because you didn't want to be amongst the crew. But then Queensland, you're alone.
And my brother.
No, but I'm sure you went in the same classes. A lot of times we're sitting in the class and you're the only person of color.
In my year, yes.
Yeah. Did you stand out when you were at school here? Is there anything, what made you stand out?
Did I stand out?
Did you stand out? What was particular about you then?
It's going to sound a bit boastful. I've always been intelligent.
That's not boastful. It's just a fact.
I've always been intelligent. I loved math. Absolutely loved it. I did additional math. Loved it even more. If I was exposed to more careers around math, I would have probably gone down that path. But the only thing I could think of what I was going to do was be a math teacher. And I didn't want to do that. So I kind of abandoned that.
Have you seen them?
I kind of abandoned that. But now that I'm older, I know things like actuarial science and so many things around being able to bring up formulas and predictions and things like that, which I would have loved to do. What made me stand out was probably math, probably intelligence.
What about other than that? What about physically? Because I've read somewhere that you were
teased
for being slim, number one.
Yes.
And because you had a larger nose than others, than normal average person, or different. Different, let's say that.
I think it wasn't so much at school.
Oh.
Surprisingly enough, I had my clique of friends, and my clique of friends were very accepting. But outside of that, I remember, surprisingly enough, one occasion I met a former primary school teacher on the streets, and she was like, oh, your nose is still big. And I was just kind of like, wow.
I didn't know that?
No, this was more around the line. This was more along the lines of, I remember you because your nose was big and your nose is still big.
And for
coming from a teacher, that was kind of like, wow.
And for you, was that like, I didn't realize that, or I know about it, but you didn't need to, you've brought it
yes,
up.
Yes, like you didn't need to. Right. I think of myself growing up, looking in the mirror, I would notice my nose. So if somebody else pointed it out, it would reinforce my noticing of the nose. Mm. If I talk in my family, it was never mentioned, simply because I'm not the only one with this nose. So it's well known. But if other people pointed it out, it would become an issue.
Would it hurt?
Yes, it would. Mm. I did not see myself as beautiful. I would look at my sister and be thinking, she's so beautiful. And because I didn't necessarily have the same features as her, so then my features became ugly. Then I would have other people outside of my circle mention it. I was very slim and I was a very late bloomer. Very late.
Were you tomboyish?
Tomboyish. But looking back, I think I was tomboyish. It was more of a response to say that, okay, I don't think of myself as attractive, so I'm not even going to bother.
Do you remember what age you started thinking about that? I mean, did you play with dolls?
No, I played with Lego. more so because of my brother. I played with Lego. Yeah. We would drive trucks around and stuff like that. My sister was way more feminine than I was. Mm. And so even when buying clothes and stuff, my sister would get like the buckled slippers. I would get the sneakers. So naturally, and so I just went into this mold of a more tomboyish. My dad loved soccer, Manchester United fan. I inherited the fandom. And so you would watch soccer every Saturday with dad. And so you would end up like the amount of soccer facts that I knew in my head, I could compete with any guy at school. I would get comments. I would hear comments of people. Because I was tomboyish, I would wear like baggy t-shirts and I would wear jeans and sneakers. I had sneakers of almost every color. So the fashion thing was in every single sphere of my life. It was just according to what I liked at that time. So I had red, yellow, blue, light blue, every single color, and I would match accordingly. I remember vividly times when I would be passing and I would overhear a conversation with people asking, is that a girl or a boy? So all those things were reinforcing the image that I had for myself. Mm. My mom put her foot down when it came to going to church.
Dress,
blouse or a dress. That's what you do. I would conform to that, at least on one day of the week. But it was only when I got to... So all those kind of comments, I'm so glad I didn't get it in my immediate circle. But because of my own idea of myself, even when I heard it outside of that circle, it would sink in. Because it was just reinforcing what I was thinking.
However, with your inner circle being obviously your family and your friends, they allowed you to be confident, believe in yourself, have self-love, mm-hmm. of course.
Yes.
So how did you block out the external noise about being a tomboy, and then on top of, mm-hmm. and she has a different mm-hmm. nose mm-hmm. to most of us, which was worse, or which was better, which bothered you the most?
I think I came to a stage where my figure bothered me more.
Maybe after
the teenage years, you want to be attractive, you have a crush on a boy, and so you aren't filling out the right way your friends are filling out.
Yeah.
So you become way more self-conscious about it. The features on my face, not so much at that point. Yeah. So by the time I'm entering into teenagehood, it is part and parcel of who I am. Mm.
And accepted
by myself.
And those that love me.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So they don't raise an issue out of it, so it's not an issue. So by that time, it was more about my figure.
So was there pressure to iwe akudia?
Yo, yes, yes. Oh my God. But it was not to do with my figure. My mom, like any African mother, looks at you, she's like, oh my goodness, you're so skinny. Please eat, please eat. And so that's what she was on. Genetically speaking, I lean towards my father. And so it takes a long time for me to put on weight. I've got high metabolism. So it takes a lot for me to put on weight. Very easy for me to lose it. I know people would be like, oh my God, I love that kind of body. Everyone would dream for it. But it actually is very difficult for me to put on weight. So even though it sometimes, at some point, it became a medical necessity for me to put on weight, it was very difficult. Mm. And so I think even into adulthood, into my 20s, my figure was still something I would look in the mirror and be like,
At which point did you say, this is me, I love me, and this is who I am?
It's funny you'd say that because, again, your inner circle's supporting you. They're telling you you're beautiful.
Absolutely. Doing that.
But as long as the voice in your head is telling you you're not, I don't think it's possible for something external to tell you any differently. So during uni, and I'll always point back to, so by this time I am now in New Zealand. I'm doing uni and it was one of the toughest years. And there were a lot of things going on with my family. There were a lot of things going on personally. And I was just finding it very, very difficult. And I, at the time, I was theming every year with something, a character of God that I wanted to make emphasis on during that year. So for that year, it was God is love. Mm-hmm. And so that was kind of the emphasis I was making, even in terms of my scripture reading and everything like that. My focus was, I need to leave this year with such a grounded conviction, the fact that God is love and what does that look like, especially mapped with his or combined with his sovereignty, because sometimes the things that happen in the world does not appear as if God is love. And so that year, because even leading into the year, it was really difficult. So I thought that I am in danger of beginning to define my God with the circumstances around me. So I needed to begin to look at everything from the lens of God is love, in order for me to survive. And so it was one of the hardest years. In that year, I was also diagnosed with depression. But it was also the year where I realized the fact that God being who he is not dependent on whether good or bad things happen to me.
Okay.
The fact that even in my lowest time, I had people where, I think my lowest point was once where, and this is where I knew that I actually needed help, because I tend to be a high functioning. So even in the time when I'm depressed, I was still showing up for church. I was still doing my assignments. I was still functioning. So anyone looking at me may not see that I am depressed. But when I realized it was a problem was I had reached a stage once where I had not bathed for 3 days. And as a Black person, you know how we take bathing. I had not bathed for 3 days. I remember sitting in my bed and thinking to myself, needing to go to the bathroom. I had not eaten. Needing to go to the bathroom and thinking to myself, but why do I even need to get up? I might as well just do it here. And that's where I woke up and said, wow.
What was that?
You are in a fix. You need help. We can't be thinking about doing this here. You naturally need help for you to entertain those thoughts. You're really, really far gone. And so I did go to some help at the uni. They did have some facilities at the uni for mental health. And that's why I discovered my diagnosis. And it began a journey. So what does God is love look like? For me, that was preservation. The Bible talks about the prodigal son, right? And when he goes out and he does everything he does. And there's a verse that comes that talks about the fact that he came unto himself and he realized, but even servants live better than this at my father's house. So let me just go back. Even if I'm a servant, I'll live better than this. So for me, that was my coming into myself moment. And I can't even think that I came into myself of my own volition. That was still God saying, I think you need to realize how far gone you are and that you need help. And so because I was looking at things from the lens of God is love, then I could see his love. I think without that, I would have blamed him to say, why didn't you stop this from happening? But instead, I could see him in the happening. And that for me solidified his definition. And so if he loves me even in that moment, even in that state, then how could I not love myself? And so it was from an overflow of that that I then began to love myself. And so all of a sudden, when other people were telling me they loved me, I was hearing it now because I loved myself. And so then even beyond loving myself became a journey of saying, I also like me. I like the way I think. I like the way I process, because I understand that this is the way God made me. And he made me this way for a reason, for a purpose.
Yes,
my physical features were made this way for a purpose. But even my character, we're seven of us. We're all very different, but we come from the same two human beings. So that already tells me that God loves diversity. And he intentionally creates people different.
Differently.
And so I need to embrace the differences and not want to be like everyone else.
Did you find that you would also now, not that you didn't love before, but did it mean that you could love more because of loving yourself? You could actually now begin to love?
I think it's more along the lines of grace. I already loved the people who are in my life. What not loving myself made me do is it made me have a hard time accepting people loving me.
So I
block them. When asking for help, I wouldn't, because I would think of myself undeserving of that help or of that love. So what growing to love myself became is I deserve this. When people give to me, when people love me, yes. But also when it came to how I saw others, it was a case of, instead of being strict line like, oh, you've got this going on, you've got this going on, you've got this going on, why don't you deal with it? I suddenly gave people grace. Because I know what it is to struggle and not accept something of yourself. So, and I know that what picked me out of that was love. And so the only way that I can help somebody else is love.
When you look back, so I'm imagining, and I was going to get to the question before you got there about the depression. It means you must have had absolutely zero confidence. But then you were a functioning person.
Yes.
So people, they couldn't see that because you just got things done.
Yeah.
But meanwhile, you were empty of within yourself because there was no love for yourself.
There are certain things about me I've always known. Like I mentioned, I'm intelligent.
We love that.
That was something, even in my most depressed state, I knew. The zero confidence was relational. It wasn't functional.
Yes.
You give me something to do, I am very confident I can do it.
Yes.
I'm very good at doing a lot of things, and I do it well. And I'm very confident in my ability to do things. What I am not confident in, or what I was not confident in, and what I struggled with for a long time, was in relation to other people. So would I be the one invited to the party? No confidence whatsoever.
Yes, I hear.
Would I be the person who people would want to hang out with? No confidence whatsoever. Would I be the person who, you know, people would willingly choose?
Socially.
Socially speaking, no confidence. Functionally speaking, confidence.
And professionally and academically.
Yes.
150%.
Which is why it's difficult for somebody to look at me and think, were you like that? Because I would still perform.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And obviously, you know, you've now gotten to a point in your career, because you're a lawyer, working for, you know, a big and important organization. And I'm sure you've had, you worked somewhere else before,
yes,
obviously at this age. People respect you, mm-hmm, and look beyond those things. I'm sitting here looking at you now, and I totally respect your story, love your story, and everything else I might have read is irrelevant, because I want to know about this amazing person who's God-fearing, mm-hmm, who is self-loving, and obviously is able to show others self-love, has been through a journey of, you know, of self-building and almost destruction, but now self-building. So I want to know what, I'm going to take you to your career a little bit, and how after New Zealand, did you come back home? And then I'm sure that was, I think the healing from your depression, from what I understand, is a constant. It's always going to be there, or can be there, because it can come up again. But what did you come back after you went through a process? When did you come back, started your work here, and then how did that translate?
So I came back to Zambia in 2015.
Were you now ready to come back? You've kind of gone through this process, or you,
no, it was still in the midst of it. I would say my whole depression journey has been 10 years.
Yeah.
10 years. That's from the time I was even diagnosed.
And lucky that you were where you were.
Yes. Yes. Lucky I was where I was. Yeah. I did have the option of medication. It's an option that I personally chose not to take.
Mm.
I did start doing a lot of exercise, watching what I eat and things like that. I became hyper vigilant when it came to my schedules, because those kept me, like, they kept me in a rhythm, kept me functioning and all that. It was only when I came back to Zambia that I even had, like, I even started things like therapy. I actually started them here. And I'm a big proponent of.
Did you have to explain surgery. This to your parents?
No. No, no. And part of the reason why I didn't want them to think it was their fault.
Yes, I thought you'd say that.
Because it wasn't. Didn't.
Yeah.
And so I thought that if I did talk about it, it would hurt them.
Mm.
And so I didn't. Yeah.
So you went through therapy when you came here to Zambia, started your career going through the journey?
Yes. So I did one final year here in terms of studying.
Okay.
I hadn't yet finished by the time I left New Zealand. I left, there were certain things that were going on with my family, and I felt that I needed to be home. So I made the decision to move back home permanently. And so that's 2015. And so I ended up with Cavendish University. They were the ones, I applied to several unis. They were the ones who gave me the most amount of credits for all the courses I had done. So it allowed me to really just finish off what was left. And it actually worked to my advantage, because it made it easy to even go on to Ziali, because I then had a Zambian degree, mm-hmm, that I could then use to apply to go to Ziali. So I then went to Ziali. So all this time, the process is still happening. This is a slow, slow journey. Sometimes I would spiral, sometimes I wouldn't.
Would you have some days where you just didn't love yourself? anymore, or it was, or you'd less love. There was less love some days.
Some days, yes. I would say that I've gone over 2 years without spiraling. Yeah. I think what has helped me now versus when it all began was the intrusive thoughts. Now, I've now got weapons against intrusive thoughts. And they wouldn't last as long. So going through therapy, what it did for me is gave me tools. Tools to, number one, identify when thoughts are not my own, what to do to process it, and also dealing with certain issues. Because remember how I said that it's difficult for me to reach out to ask for help. And those are things that I had to work through. Because one of the biggest issues around depression is isolation. And so even when I'm talking to people and they're struggling with the same thing, I'll always ask, okay, who are you staying with? When was the last time you talked to them? Or I'll ask the people around them how engaging they are, because one of the concerning signs would be isolation.
Yes, yes.
And so getting those tools have aided me to be able to to really deal with this. I also had a struggle with anxiety, panic attacks while I was in uni. The thing around that is, for that one, I got completely healed from that through my journey that same year for God is Love.
They're not really connected though, are
they?
They're
not really connected. They're two different things. But I would get panic attacks to the point of even fainting. But that one, I got healed. That one I put it, I know that God was the one who healed me from that one. But depression has not been the same journey.
No.
But it's the same healing. To the point where coming out of it, now one of the things I did even for my church was create a program around breaking free from depression, anxiety, and addictions. And creating a program for people. Because I had the benefit of being diagnosed outside. I had the benefit of having that exposure to know that there is nothing wrong with having therapy. But Zambia is still in a very stigmatized culture,
yes,
where anything around mental health is looked down on.
Yes.
And so what took me 10 years to figure out, the tools that I built over these years to make it into a program that people can access within 6 weeks, is something I then became passionate about. So then for me, it's not an issue around, oh, did God heal you or not? But it was, this journey became necessary because it allowed me to build tools. It allowed me to understand the scriptures in a way that I've never understood it. Because yes, I went for therapy. I didn't necessarily choose a Christian therapist. I just wanted somebody who was competent and able to do the work. But because of my knowledge of scriptures and knowledge of theology, a lot of the tools I was given was actually biblical based. And so to be able to tie so much of my faith into my journey, into the tools, the practical tools people can use in order to deal with what they're dealing with, means that depression is not a label that you bounce around to say, oh, I'm depressed or whatever. Mm. It is just, it is something that you acknowledge, and you then, once you acknowledge it, you can then equip yourself with tools to be able to deal with it so that you can then function.
And I think, you know, the sad part, maybe with a number of mental illnesses, is the acknowledging and accepting. And I think you were very lucky to have acknowledged it yourself,
mm-hmm.
And accepted it yourself. Mm-hmm. I think that's probably the most difficult part for so many people. So are you very active in the supporting, doing this within the church, where you're supporting other people too?
Yes, I was. I was very, I love the fact that at our church we've got so many people in different disciplines. So reached out to those people who are actually psychologists,
yeah,
and said, this is what I want to do.
Yeah.
And running my tools by them and together with them creating a program, because this is what they do professionally.
Mm.
So it became a thing of, I get this is what you do. And most likely, even in the way you do it, you're not as free to bring in your faith. as you would be having it done in the church. So now I'm tying all the tools that you are giving me to scripture. Now I'm tying everything to your faith so that when you're doing it, because even in the church, God forbid a Christian is depressed because apparently we're not supposed to be. So it was to be able to create a safe environment for people to understand that you can be fully saved, fully with faith in God, in Jesus Christ, and struggle with this. What does that look like? To not have to go through the same struggles, theological struggles I went through around that, and actually give you biblical truth around even getting help. So because of that, I also felt safe doing it again because they were trained psychologists who came alongside me and came up with this program. So we launched it earlier this year, and the feedback was really, really good around those people who managed to take part in it.
Okay, awesome. So again, going back, came back, still managing your mental health, career, first job.
First job, right. So when you're at Ziali, you have to be attached to a law firm or a legal department. So I ended up being attached to the Attorney General Chambers. And so that was my whole journey. But
could you wear heels, though?
Yes. No, in fact, you're required to. One thing about law, it's
heels
what
black.
People don't understand is our practice rules, which are the rules that you use. They tell us everything from what you can wear to how to do your hair, actually require a minimum of 2-inch heels for women.
Minimum?
Yes. So is it 2-inch or 1-inch? 1-inch because it's 2 centimeters. So 1-inch heels, yes, okay. A minimum. So even when you go to Ziali, they are very strict on you upholding the practice rules because you are you're getting to become a lawyer. And so it's actually, I've chosen the perfect profession for my love of heels.
Yes.
But also because at the time I had to walk to, like, from Attorney General Chambers because it's like behind the High Court. Mm-hmm. And then Ziali is in Rhodes Park. So I would walk, me and other people who were there, we would walk from work to Ziali because classes were in the afternoon. You can't wear heels.
No, of course not.
So I had the whole range of flat
shoes. And trainers.
Yeah, and trainers, yes. The whole range of them loved it. Then when you reach Ziali, you change your shoes, put heels, and you walk in. I managed to clear Ziali first attempt. So I, my first job, cleared Ziali 2017. My first job was with the Competition and Consumer Protection Commission. So entered there as a legal officer. Such a great experience. Such a great experience. I would say it was only God. it was not on my radar. Mm. It was not. I did prefer being in-house than being in a law firm. Mm-hmm. Simply because I'll say this very carefully. Other people are watching. Litigation is not my favorite part of being a lawyer.
Right.
Still do it to this day.
Yeah.
But it's not the favorite part. Remember the dream?
Is it the business part?
Yes. Remember the dream of mergers?
Yes.
The contracts.
The skyscraper.
Yes. That's not the courtroom. So that has always been my leaning. So joining CCPC was such a great experience because it exposed me on the competition side to mergers. And also just investigations around anti-competitive conduct. Because of the nature of the work, you get exposed to quite a number of large companies. And I also get exposed to a lot of senior lawyers because the large companies would hire the senior lawyer.
Of course.
And so I think that level of exposure is something that I can never take for granted. I think Mrs. Banda, who was my boss at the time, she was board secretary there, and she, Mrs. Mwanza, and she was very big on giving people opportunities. Those, you can lead the cross-examination, even if it's a big matter and all that. So she was, so I got so many opportunities because of that. And so all this exposure allowed me, I think it equipped me faster than if I was in any other kind of environment.
Or in a straight down the line legal firm.
Yes, in a legal firm, yes. So that, like, really that exposure put me ahead, I think. Very big, she was very big on, look, if you know the stuff, why don't you be the one to talk?
Yeah.
So again, with the kind of cases that you deal with larger entities. So the exposure, even in terms of meetings and things like that, is quite large. So I really, really was grateful for all that exposure. And also because I didn't quite know where I wanted to lean myself into.
But the exposure allowed you to sort of have a bit of everything,
yes,
and
exactly.
Allow you to say, that's where.
That's where I want to be, yes. So after like over 2.5 years, going on to 3, I decided an opportunity came up in the financial sector with the Pensions and Insurance Authority there, the regulator there. And so I took that. It was a bit of a, because from a regulator that basically has the whole economy of Zambia as their playing field, to narrowing down to one sector, it was a jump. also a different type of regulation. But again, because of the finance background, I also studied it and wanting to immerse myself more into that.
Do you love your job?
Yes, I do.
Yeah, you sound like you really do.
I really do love my job. I love what I do.
I can see it. And I think this is why you woke up on a Monday
to just say,
happy Monday.
Yes.
Because yes. I'm loving Monday and I'm loving me,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
From my natural me.
Yes.
And I guess you went to work or you sent a message or were you a keen Instagrammer?
Yes, I was. I have always been. I would post 1 or 2 times a week, 3 yeah. times a week if it's a busy week,
yeah.
Of posting. And it's funny because it wasn't the first Monday selfie. If you look at my profile, there are so many selfies at my desk. It's not even the first Happy Monday selfie. It was one of those things where my hair had come out the way I imagined it to come out that day. I had done a face mask that weekend, so I felt that my skin was glowing.
Yeah, and you're like, we're on.
Like, you know, this Monday, like, bring on the week. Yes. And so I posted as per usual. You know the kind of thing where I had a video beforehand. Mm. I had a video that I had done in like April this year. I remember because I had done the video, ended up doing the video while I was on a work trip in SA. One of the things I love to do is skincare. And so I make posts around the different things that I use and what works for me. And so there was a mask that I'd been using. And so I had used it long enough that I could now vouch for it.
Yeah.
So I wanted to do a post on it. So I did a video about the fact that I had put on a mask and that next morning I was removing it. And so it's one of those masks that's a peel-off mask. So it kind of looks like you've got a plastic on your face
yeah.
when you appear. So I just did a video around like, oh, so this is the mask I'm using. Let me just peel it off and you'll see how my skin looks. I did that. It went haywire. So I'm kind of wondering, I'm like, huh, like, has somebody posted my video somewhere suspicious and then people are starting to come to me?
Someone sponsoring this? People put money behind it?
It was a bit like, huh, this has never happened to me. But anyway, but it was where I started getting comments like, is this a filter?
Mm.
So I thought they were meant that, oh, she just hasn't finished watching the video to the end. So they think that the plasticky skin is what I'm portraying as my skin. But they haven't seen me peel it off. So that's why they are talking about filters and all that jazz. So I was just like, it's what it is. It's the internet and whatever.
Yeah.
Some mean comments, but I was just kind of like, huh, okay. But it's few and far in between. when I did a couple of months later, I'm now doing...
Like how mean?
For example, that same post, I had posted about how I was 37 and this is how my skin is, right? And all that jazz. And somebody posted, oh, I thought she flipped the numbers around. So she's like, she looks way older than she claims to be. So I was just kind of like,
okay,
how is that even possible? Like, even if you want to exaggerate. So then I would get comments around like the plain ones is that, oh, no, you're ugly. They would make or they would send all these GIFs of noses.
Mm.
I came to a stage where if I saw on my notification that somebody sent a GIF, I wouldn't even bother opening it because I was just like, oh, there's nothing that I need to see. And so by the time the selfie came, like even then I thought it was just random.
Yeah.
So by the time the selfie came, and then it just went haywire. So I'm starting to get notifications on my phone, like what's going on. And it started off positive. And then I call it the second day syndrome because like the first people who see my post are normally my following.
Yes.
So they're
before all, they've now shared.
Yes. Before they've now shared or because of their engagement, it now gets posted on other people's feed.
Yes.
So the first day is normally positive. People are loving on me and everything. Then the next day is when you normally start getting the other kind of comments. And that's where I started realizing when they talk about filter, they're meaning my nose.
Yeah.
Or that's where I started getting comments around, you should do rhinoplasty. Some of them were talking about how I'm too ugly to be on the internet.
Did some of those comments trigger those things Or because you were now in a place where you couldn't be hurt
as much. I think I thought I was okay.
Right.
I thought I was okay. And this was always going to be the litmus test as to whether I was okay.
Yes.
And so the fact that I got angry was already a sign that I wasn't completely okay.
Mm.
Because I always give the example, because, you know, like I said, the one area I'm very confident in is my intelligence, right? If somebody were to tell me, oh, Naomi, you're so dumb. It wouldn't even faze me.
No.
I wouldn't even get upset. I would just be like, okay. Right? So because somebody said, oh, you've got bad fashion sense. I'll be like,
oh, okay. That's
it doesn't. But the fact that it got a reaction out of me told me there's something still there.
So how did you pull back from that reaction? And what was your reaction?
My reaction was anger. But we have to understand that anger is a secondary emotion. It's not a primary emotion.
Okay.
And so if you're angry, there is something primary there. A lot of times it's hurt. And so I one day I got upset, and I've always been this kind of person who, and my mentor says this, she says, if you don't have to convince yourself, you don't have to convince other people that you are who you are. She uses the analogy of an orange. If you're an orange, just be an orange. You don't have to convince yourself or convince others that you're an orange tree. Just bear fruit.
Yeah.
So I wasn't going to start, you know, putting like answering people. I don't have to explain myself. But I think one day I was just in a bad mood that day. I see a comment around rhinoplasty and I'm just like, that's it. I've had enough. Because I'd also get people in my inbox also telling me about how ugly I was or the vomiting emoji and all that jazz. And I never understood why people have got time. Like, okay, I can see that a post can randomly come on your feed. But for you to go to somebody's inbox now to start telling them.
That's a lot of hate.
It is. And it can't be about me. You've got a lot of hate.
Check yourself.
or people who then go to several of my other posts to then comment on the others. So it was really bad. And I think that morning I was really, really upset. So somebody had commented that. So I decided to put her on blast. You can do a video reply to a comment. So I did a video reply to her comment. And I was just in the video, I was literally just like pointing at the comment and just kind of motioning as if I'm speechless about the comment. And the caption was around along the lines of, you know, if like sometimes I'm left speechless in these comments. And I did it intentionally because I knew like I didn't want to be the person who goes on the comments and puts people on blast. But I knew that if I pointed out this comment, people will do the work for me. So they would go to her profile, yeah. They would do the work that I wanted. And so that's what I did. I posted it up and God being God was kind of like, yeah, fam, we don't do that here. Take that down. Take that down. And I'm just kind of like, but it's not me. And they're being mean. And quite frankly, people shouldn't have the right to do and say that to me. He's like, we don't do that here. That's not for you to do. Take it down. So I remember it was like, 20,000 views, God. Do I really need to delete this? So by the end of the day, I took it down and I'm calling my sister and I'm just kind of like, and she's emphasizing the fact that Naomi, you're pissed off. Why are you pissed off? Why is this pissing you off? If you're okay, you wouldn't be pissed off.
Yeah.
So I then just do a bigger deep dive to say that, okay, maybe this is an opportunity. I could either just brush this off and just say, this is affecting me. It's triggering me. So let me just remove all the triggers from my scope of attention so I can remove the photo, I can do whatever and live happily ever after. Or I can take this opportunity to deal with something that I didn't, that I thought I had finished dealing with.
Yeah.
And so I chose to say, okay, fine. God, you told me to take it down. I've taken it down. What do you want? What's going on here? And just coming to a place of understanding, just a greater conviction to be like, I mean, we all talk about the fact that, you know, we're fearfully and wonderfully made. But I don't think we truly grasp, because what ended up getting to me, and it actually almost broke my heart, was the fact that if God intentionally put you together, every single one of my features, because again, yes, I've got my father's nose, I've got my mother's other features and stuff like that. But the fact that this feature was chosen to be put on me was God. It wasn't like a lottery. It wasn't like, oh, a guessing game. Let me blind my eyes and just pick something. No, it was intentional. And so if, for example, I make a painting and you laugh at the painting, is it the painting you're laughing at or is it me who painted it that you would be laughing at? So to understand that we live in a world of such ignorance or disrespect to God, the creator, that we are comfortable to laugh at his creation. And I wasn't even removed from that. I didn't even remove myself from that because it was a self-check. Because I have looked at pictures and started laughing. I have thought, I may not comment it, but I've thought it. Or I'll just laugh to myself. But that was also another being that God fashioned with. And he said, I will put this together in my way. Who are you, a fellow created being, to laugh, then laugh at that?
Laugh at that. So I'm seeing your parents being the painters. And hence you protecting them from people laughing at their work. Or even what you'd said more around the therapy kind of linked. But I'm seeing your parents being the painters of this.
Because yes, creation. You can't laugh at me without laughing at my father. Right? And who are you? Yeah. Who are you to laugh at my father?
Yeah.
You have no right.
Right.
Yeah.
Tell me, so your sister played a key role when this was all happening. How did you move forward from this? We've got 530. 530,000 commenters on this. How did you then move forward? Because now this spins around to like, guys, no. And the attention
is building.
It's building.
So I think it came part of, I came to a stage of again debating about deleting it. Because it was getting a lot of attention and I was just like, it's not worth it.
Yeah.
I want to continue with my life. And so like one of the things I did, like I'm debating on whether to delete it. And because I'm still getting the negative comments, even after this revelation, even after all this is going on, I'm still getting the comments. So I made a video around like my revelation and everything like that. And then I am thinking, should I delete this? Should I not delete this? And I realized one of the things that God was telling me was that, you know, what the enemy meant for evil, because this was meant to destroy you.
Mm-hmm.
With my history of depression,
mm-hmm.
with what I've been exposed to, this had the potential to utterly destroy
you.
God will work out for my good. And what I love about that passage of scripture in Genesis is the fact that it's not that God is surprised that this is the enemy's plan. He's not surprised. So in the same way the enemy was planning and putting things together, God was also planning and putting things together. So it's not even that he's necessarily turning it around for my good. It was always meant to be for my good.
Mm.
And so if I'm going to lean on what the enemy wanted, as opposed to what God planned for this to be, then the enemy would win. And so I ended up leaving it. See, okay, God, I will leave it. I will leave it.
And when you say leave it, does that literally mean you weren't thinking about it? You mean leaving it up?
Leaving it up.
Okay.
I will leave it up. I would still get comments here and there, but I would just, I would just ignore
it. Did your mind move away from it and you kind of got on with things, or did you keep going to check on it? Or
what? No. It's like, pinging. I had that by that time, like even my following grew.
Yes.
My following did grow. So I did other posts and things
totally
like that.
You couldn't totally ignore.
Yes.
Happening.
So I would just post something else. But what I did notice about it was it affected me in the sense that I became scared to post selfies. And so I would take a photo, like a selfie of myself, because I would think, I look good. Let me take a photo. But then I would think twice about posting it. I would then start posting selfies on my stories as opposed to as a post. And then a couple, like a month or so later, I was again in another country traveling and I had taken a selfie and I really loved the way I looked. And I looked happy.
Yeah.
Because I was happy.
Yes.
And so I clocked myself second guessing whether I should post it. And I realized even if this scarred me, and I remember once listening to a sermon by a friend of mine, and she was talking about the fact that sometimes we can overcome something and think we have defeated the enemy, but there's a seed that has been planted.
Mm.
And at one point in time, it will grow.
Mm.
And so for me, yes, not taking down the post and not responding in the manner people wanted me to respond was a victory. But I didn't understand that there had been a seed that had been planted around fearing posting myself.
Yes.
And so I told myself, I said, Naomi, if you don't deal with this now, you won't ever post a selfie again. And so I posted that selfie. And I'm just like, I'm happy. That's the caption. And so, again, the second day syndrome. Like, the first day, everything's good. Second day. But I could look at those negative comments and just be like, huh. And that, to me, again, another litmus test. But this time I passed.
After this, it was an episode, an incident.
Mm-hmm.
It's not even an incident. It's like, it's an episode. It's because there's a story to it.
Mm-hmm.
how has this affected your life now?
I think I was in denial about this whole thing. One of the wake-up calls, even before the People magazine interview happened, one of my wake-up calls was I had traveled to Mauritius for work. I was in the hotel having breakfast. This lady walks up to me and she's like, "I know you." And I'm like, "Oh, okay.
I don't know you." Okay.
She's like, "Yeah, you're on social media." I'm like, "Yes, Instagram." She's like, "I follow you." And I'm just like, wow. And she's from Kenya. Like, I can even hear the accent. She's like, "No, I follow you on Instagram. I really, really like what you post." And I'm just like, "Thank you so much." But it was such a shocking thing for me because I'm like, I am here in another country. You're also here from another country. And we randomly meet and you're able to recognize me.
Yes.
And then when I was flying back home, I had flown through Dubai. And so I was at Dubai airport and somebody messages me on Instagram and he's like, "I can see you. You're at Dubai airport." And I'm like, "Wait, what?"
Yeah.
He's like, "Are you not at Dubai airport?" I'm like, "I am." He's like, "I can see you. I am looking at you right now." And I'm just like, oh, wow. This is not just on my phone.
Yeah.
So that was before people.
Then tell me about.
So then after people.
And how did people get hold of you?
So one of the editors, Nathan, he had seen the video that I made dealing with the whole hate messages and all that. He had seen it. It came on his feed. And he's like, "It's a 10-minute video." If you know social media and Instagram, 10-minute videos are not the thing. Like, they don't get watched. They don't even get thrown on people's feed.
Yeah.
That's what happens. So he's like, "I watched it. And I even watched it to the end." And then he's like, "I said I needed to get in touch with you. I needed to know more about the story." So he got in touch with me. I remember he sent me an Instagram message. And I'm already like, "Huh. Okay, People Magazine, as in People Magazine, People Magazine." I even had to Google him to just make sure he was who he was saying.
I hope he said the same thing when we called you. Inkwazi Magazine, Inkwazi. I can just see it.
So he, so then we hop off the social media, get into exchanging emails and start chatting. And he's like, "Look, I would love to have an interview." And I'm thinking, oh, why not? Hey, it's a feel-good people story.
It's a loving myself story.
So yeah, so I can just do an interview and it'll be fine. And I was thinking it was going to be something I can boast about. Like, I can put on my profile to say I was in People Magazine. I didn't think it would go haywire or anything. I just thought that it would be for me to claim.
Yes.
Kind of thing. And so beginning of August, we had the interview. And so I remember that day I was actually conducting interviews at work. So I was all dressed up, serious and everything. And then I had the interview with him. And he was like, "Oh, no, at the end of the month, it's going to come out. Should be good." So I'm even telling my workmates, "Oh, my God, People Magazine interviewed me. It's so great." And all that. Because they have been also part and parcel. Other than my other friends, they have also been part and parcel
journey.
With this journey kind of thing. I would be telling them, I'm like, "Fam, my following is growing." I think at some point in time, it was getting to 1,000 a day being added. So, and I would be like,
almost 200, yeah.
What's going on? And then, so when this is happening, I'm like, "Guys, People Magazine, and I've done the interview." And I'm like, "Yeah, I'll tell you when it's out. I'll tell you, I'll even send you the link." That's how I thought it was going to be. Like, if people want to see it, I'm going to be the one to have to send them a link.
And
he told me, he's like, "Oh, it's up. Here's the link." So I go to it. I love the article. I love the fact that he just kept true to what our conversation was. It was so beautiful. So I'm sending it to my family. I'm sending it to people I know. I'm posting it up on my WhatsApp status. Like, "Hey, fam, I did a thing. I'm on People Magazine and all that jazz." And then I begin to notice that, this is getting a little bit more traction than I thought it was going
to
be.
I can't go to the supermarket, like, or I do, and then?
The next day I'm like, "Oh my goodness, what's going on?" And then I'm like, "Okay, I think I need to call my mother to just give her a warning because she's not on social media. Then I'm like, okay, mom. So first I have to explain. I'm like, so this is a thing called social media where I post. And I did this interview and now things are going a little bit out of my control. Yeah. So you may get a few phone calls from people. And I just wanted to tell you so that you know what it's about. Then it's getting worse. Or should it get better?
Yeah.
And then more. I'm like, okay, so maybe I need to call dad. Because I know mom's far removed, but dad's further removed. But I think it had reached a stage where I'm like, I think I need to tell dad before he also starts getting phone calls.
This doesn't even wait for that weekly. Can't wait for that.
No, it can't. It's the kind of stuff I'm telling my dad. I'm like, the same story. So this thing called social media, where I normally post. And so this is what's happened. And he's like, okay. So I'm like, so you may get phone calls from people, but I just wanted to give you a heads up. I'll even send you the article so that you read it and everything. Everything's okay. But just in case somebody decides to call you to ask about it, this is what it's about. And so I think at the time my mom was even like, oh, my mom was overjoyed because she was like, oh my God, you talked about God, the scriptures. So she was just like, my daughter is spreading the gospel. She was overjoyed. My dad was more along the lines of, will this affect you professionally? You're a lawyer. Can you be in this kind of media?
What if they said at work?
What do they say at work? So he was along those lines. And he was more like, how could you do this? Like, it will affect you and all that. So I think even then, because he didn't get any kind of feedback then. But then the next day, he started getting calls. Like, it's now me, your daughter, da-da-da-da-da, and all that. And I think for him, what really got him to realize this is big was when he started getting calls from outside the country.
Yeah.
Then he's like, they're telling me
to Ngefi,
that side, no. And then they're telling me this person from the UK. And I'm just like, dad, it's come to the stage where I can't do anything.
Did you have to hold the family? Like, was there like a call? Did you have to have a call with the brothers and sisters? Like, guys.
Well, the brothers and sisters were more along the lines of, okay, it did affect them, but they didn't bring it up. They would get phone calls from people, but they didn't bring it up.
With you?
With me. My parents, because it's never happened, they were more of the ones who are like...
affected?
Affected. And, oh my God, I kept on reminding them, this is a good thing. It could have been a sex tape. But it was about self-love. Let's keep perspective here. I had to make a number of calls, just calming them down, just calming them down to be like, okay, work were very supportive. So I could comfort my dad to say, no, work has got no problem. In fact, if I was in private sector, they would have probably blasted my face everywhere. Church is fine with it, treating me no differently. Profession wise, they're fine with it. At some point in time, somebody got in touch with me to just let me know that they were okay with it. So just reassuring, because they're coming from a generation where publicity is not necessarily a good thing.
Of course. Yeah. Yeah.
So for them, this level of publicity was like, and they're also very private people. So to get everything blasted, they weren't very comfortable with it.
So tell me now, we've turned something that was something so negative has turned into something so beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you've really sent a huge message to so many people. I think now, even if they haven't heard your story about really other, you know, where you've come from, just maybe more on, even more about the confidence and the self-love. From an emotional perspective, yes. A physical perspective.
Yes.
How do you want to take this? You're already taking things forward for the mental health.
Mm-hmm.
What would you be saying to people who have been affected by not loving themselves physically? What would you say to people who need to love themselves?
I think, firstly, my story resonated with a lot of people.
Yeah.
Because a lot of people don't think themselves are beautiful. And so to a certain extent, and one of my friends blasted me for this. She blasted me for this because one of the things I was quoted as saying was, I'm not aesthetically beautiful.
Yes.
She blasted me for that statement. She's like, how could you say that? You're beautiful. And I get where she was coming from. I completely understand where she was coming from. I think a lot of my story resonates because my appearance is not what would conventionally be called beautiful. If there was a beauty pageant and there were 10 contestants and I was one of them, I wouldn't be the go-to winner. However, and I'm not saying that self-deprecatingly, like I'm not trying to look down on myself. Mm-hmm. What I'm saying is you need to be okay with other people not finding you beautiful. That shouldn't define your own beauty. So if you don't find me beautiful, okay. That's fine by me. I can find myself beautiful.
If you don't like orange, it's fine. There's an apple.
Exactly. So I don't want the story to be that. I don't want it necessarily to be that everyone is beautiful. I want the story to be that you need to be okay with who you are, every part of you, to an extent that somebody else can disagree with you and it's okay. And that's what I want. Because people would look at my story and other people, I've had people message me to say that people would think I'm aesthetically beautiful, but I don't consider myself beautiful. So the key here is not to even be physically in certain proportions that makes them look as if they're accepted. The key here is you can never use external validation to fix something internally. It can't work. It's like what I said at the beginning, my inner circle, my friends, my family affirmed me. They told me I was beautiful. But because I myself did not consider myself beautiful, the only thing that affirmed that was when other people talked negative. That's what I latched onto.
Yeah.
So it's the same thing here. Everyone can call you beautiful, but if you do not consider yourself beautiful, everything is just noise. You won't be able to hear it. But if I'm beautiful, to the extent where I love the support I've gotten, I absolutely love it. But I don't need people telling me I'm beautiful to think I am beautiful.
Mm.
So if there's a message I want people to get, it's that. Mm. The message isn't, I think we are, as a society, we're obsessed with beauty.
Of course, yes.
We are obsessed with beauty. And I come
physical
beauty. And the problem with that is, but why? If you look at the Bible, Jesus is described as somebody whose features were obscure, that no one could even, his features had nothing to say for it. He was so mundane and so normal that Jesus needed to kiss him on the cheek for other people to recognize that this is Jesus. I know in movies we tend to use a handsome person to act as him, but the Bible, in terms of the physical description, did say that he had no feature that would distinguish himself from anyone else. He wasn't handsome or beautiful. I don't need to be beautiful. We've tied beauty to worth.
Yeah.
And so I don't want to be tied to a story or a plot that then says, oh, well, then all beautiful. No, I want you to look at yourself, love yourself, like yourself exactly the way you're made. Be okay with that.
Be okay.
Be okay with that. Whether you're tall, short, whether you're fat, slim, whether you are curvier or straighter. Love you.
You know what? Nkosi are going to kill me because they had I haven't even focused or touched on some of the things that we were meant to talk about, because this has been really beautiful.
Wow.
And I have to say, I've said very little in I don't know how long we've been talking for. Honestly, you have made this probably my most beautiful interview.
Oh, wow, thank you.
Because you've brought it to the room and I have learnt self-worth. I have learnt gratitude. I have learnt Ubuntu. I have learnt hope.
Yeah.
For so many people. Through just having a chat with you. I'm so grateful. Naomi, this felt like 15 minutes and we've sat here for quite a long time.
Yeah.
I've had an amazing time learning about you, learning your story because it's truly unique. And I think you have made a mark and you have genuinely given people out there and women and Zambians and anybody of any color something to think about, and I'm really grateful for your time.
Thank you so much for having me. I think I've enjoyed telling my story. You've pushed me to tell it in ways I wasn't expecting to, but I'm so glad you did. I really, really do hope that anyone who's watching this, listening to this, takes something home, not just to think about, but to do.
Thank you.